Today, we are going to talk about inequality in general, philosophically and also ideologically. And joining us today is Bhavna. She is interested in policy making and in pursuit of it. And she also has an educational background of sociology, economics and political science. She is here to share her thoughts with us on this topic. Over to you, Bhavna.
Okay, so as a student who have been engaging with social sciences for so many years, I'll say 5 years. So it kind of gave me an inspiration to, you know, create value for the knowledge I've garnered. So it's pretty much on the paper, academically. Mm. It's on the paper. So I want to create value for the knowledge I've garnered. So I would say I'm informed that by that motive to pursue policy making, so which would actually equip me with skills to draft policies that can bring about changes.
So I'm hoping for a very interesting conversation with you on this topic, and I'll be looking forward to having more of these. What is inequality in a sociological definition?
In most basic terms, it is unequal distribution of anything, like such that there is some concentration involved, like one section benefiting and the other section left out, in the most basic terms. So sociologically speaking, it's a function of various factors that has primarily to do with power dispersion, like power is the agency or means ultimately where we get to, you know, garner resources. Like once you have power, you have the means to anything, like be it any resource, be it adding into your cultural capital or social capital or something as fundamental as money, which is the major driver in a scenario governed by economics.
Okay. Do you think inequality that exists in India is anywhere different from a Western context?
Yes, it has very much to do with the social setting of the Western nations as well as our India. Because the stratification is informed by a setup of class system. Like there's a class system, like a haves and the have-nots. If I bring in Marxism, like with reference to the rapid industrialization, that kind of informed the base of class formation in West. Transformation invest. So, yeah, it is pretty much about economy and race, like the natives and the whites, the colonization that came about.
Okay.
And India too was a subject to colonization, but we did have a variable in place already. So, British didn't really have to kind of set up a race
incorporate
system.
Inequality.
In India, yes.
We already were certified, right? So what were they?
It's fundamentally based on caste. And caste has its origin from race, I believe. The Dravidian, the Aryan, the kind of standoff between both.
Mm-hmm.
And how we dispersed into caste groups. The history part of it has many more details of how caste came about. But fundamentally, it again is about power dispersion. Like there's this one section and the subcaste under it well off, overwhelmingly well off than the other, who seem to be left out of everything. Like something as fundamental as, you know, access to basic necessities. Like, yes, that's what I believe. Like caste is the
driving force of inequality
in
within
India.
Indian context.
Yes, yes.
So since our independence, let's say till the British were here, we couldn't make any measures to address these inequalities. Although some provinces were making really significant efforts to address it, let's, for the argument's sake, presume that they didn't. From independence, it's been like 7+ decades. We have had multiple government changes, ideological changes, and different parties have ruled us, different coalition governments have ruled us. How do you evaluate the way our governments have addressed these inequalities?
I would like to bring in my knowledge in economics in this aspect. Like, we all know agriculture is the mainstay of Indian economy. Like, overwhelming proportion of our population since independence, before independence, have engaged with something that has to do with land. So, the major input in agriculture is land. So, let's speak with respect to how the question of land distribution was addressed by the policymakers. We can see there were a lot of indiscrepancies, loopholes at the implementation level. So, something as basic as land that would determine a person's income with the kind of economic setting we have here, that is primarily from agriculture, most of the income people derive from, something as basic as that couldn't get through, okay? This because there were a lot of, you know, loopholes coming in, and it again traces its origin back to stratification. Like, end of the day, elite holds on to what they have. They don't want to give away. Not give away. Give away would be a very shallow term.
Give up.
That. See, that is coming from a place of privilege. Give away. Because it's not donation. It's you're just asking for what you've been held back from.
Yeah. See, they might own it, but they haven't earned it.
Yes.
Yeah. Both in philosophical terms as well as economical terms.
Yes.
In no way they own it. Nice insights. So, do you think any possible movement towards addressing those inequalities will result in better economical results for India as a democracy, for India as an upcoming superpower, rising superpower?
I don't think so, as long as we don't address the question of stratification.
Like, yeah, that's what I asked. Mm-hmm. If we address these inequalities and if we really strategize and mobilize towards, let's not say resolving, but let's say addressing and kind of rectifying these inequalities at their source level or at the surface level at least, do you think that might profit us in terms of economical growth and in terms of our overall development as a society?
Yes, the motive is to equip them with an agency, the marginalized with an agency, because they're kept at the margin, like forbidden from any kind of access to the resources, which is fundamental for their growth. So once they have the agency, of course, that would mean more participants in the drive for economic growth. So more the participants, better the quality of inputs, because I would believe it would result in a significant degree of economic growth than where we are actually standing now.
Okay. What, if any, suggestive or ideal ways that can possibly be employed in place to address these inequalities? Maybe, let's say, economic policies or social policies or any sort of political strategies that we can put in place.
I would say to bring in more quality inputs, we need more sound policies that are inclusive. Mm. Inclusive in the sense it must be sensitive to the cultural and social setting. Like, it must be acknowledged that there can be stratification within stratification. It's not basic. It's very complicated and intricate in structure. So all that has to be addressed to kind of draft the sound policies that can, you know, bring about change, because end of the day, the question goes back to whether or not it can be effective.
Yeah. So let me deviate from the flow that we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask you one more thing. How much gender inequality is different in Indian context compared to the Western?
Gender inequality in Indian context, I would say, has more subscribers than in West, at least speaking from my day-to-day experiences, where the women in my life has demonstrated this instinct to stay oppressed, even with agency to power, to education, anything that could have informed a change of thought, a change of value. I see them holding on to this system, kind of, you know, accentuating to more elevation so that it's more firm in place, and holding others back who are kind of making the remotest effort to break it or dismantle it. So I would say in India, it is very much fed into by the people who are oppressed.
Mm.
In West, we can see there's kind of a degree of demonstration, like more discourse on how inequality is a major detriment to growth, like women in themselves coming up in the terms of, like, we could say the call for right to vote in that sense, like the overwhelming response in West. And I have not seen any movements to the scale it has been in West in India.
Okay. So I just wanted to share an insight into the point that you're making, just to add to it. So in Western context, basically, it's all black and white, right and left, yes and no, high and low,
mm.
oppressed and the oppressor. So whenever there is some sort of informed rebellion or revolution or uprising towards the oppressors, it is so textual that the person who is being oppressed is going to rise against the oppressor. That is what happens in the feminism arena regarding West. So women were oppressed for too long by men. They are counter attacking now, kind of bringing up their own race, let's say. But in Indian context, what happens, we have created a very systemic hierarchy where women themselves have mm. women under them,
yes,
and above them.
I agree.
And you subscribe to the idea of having someone under you, you automatically subscribe to the idea of being below someone. So this has essentially resulted in women being the oppressors more than men for other women. And they endorse the system, they endorse the hierarchy more than men. So apart from patriarchy, the kind of oppression that women face by women is more here, which is why they might feel like, or they might look like, seem like, that they are accepting towards a system that is unequal, and they're accepting a system that is treating them unfair. But from their point of view, they seem to be in a fine place, as long as they have someone under them. Who is above them is not the matter of discussion. So when that comes to the realization, then we might see greatly mobilized feminist movements or fights or arguments against the inequalities that are faced by women. Like you said, yeah, in India, we see more of acceptance and submissiveness towards this inequality rather than the fight back.
Yes. At least that's what I have noticed engaging with write-ups about movements. Like, I would say, even though there is a call for reform, how we look at it is again informed by the system in place. Like, this call is made by elite women mostly, who has the agency, and agency cannot be taken out of context. Like, it's essentially what keeps them in proximity with how the mechanisms to get things done. So yeah, it is confined to that elite sections of women, and again, their attitudes and values, there's no ruling out, is informed by the ideology that has been ingrained into them, which again finds its origin in a system that we have mentioned is very discriminatory in nature. So many a times they kind of neglect the issues that a woman from a marginalized community is subject to. It is very entirely different from what elite women must be dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Like, there's this vast, you know, degree of difference. Like, it could be pictured as levels, like, you know, one as being better off than the other.
Yeah, true. So when we say, like, feminism in India, we can easily, like, make an argument that it is mostly about addressing the rights or addressing the issues that are faced by privileged upper class, upper caste women, rather than the women who don't even have a voice in this society. Because we have so many levels of men under these women who don't have a voice. We have so many more layers of women under those men who don't have a voice. So finding that last downtrodden, oppressed, a scheduled tribe or scheduled caste woman's voice in this hierarchy is pretty much impossible, I would say. So moving on.
As a student, we've been taught that any question to address this inequality involves policy measures or instruments to kind of compensate for or undo the defects of the system. So in spite of this discourse on policy measures in place, like there's a large, let's say, or a major degree of discussion as to what policy measures can be brought in, and many policies have come about as a result. And still, statistics say so that social inequality is a thing that is what very much entrenched in the system that is very not easy to dismantle. So why do you think, where do you think policies have failed?
See, in policy itself, we have discrepancies, okay? There are some really good policies with really good forward thinking and actual positive motive behind them to make a change. And there are policies which just look like they are going to make progress, but they might be political stunts or just another way for privileged people to get more privilege. So let's leave the second category out. Let's talk about the policies that have the potential to make change and why they don't do it. The answer is very simple. The bureaucracy that we have in India right now is still very much ridden by this ridiculousness of hierarchy. And we still have people from the upper layers of the hierarchy coming into these positions and coming into these offices. No matter how good the policies are, the ideology behind the political party that is making it, or the ideology and understanding behind the bureaucrat that is making it, but on the root level and at the very end of the reception point to the society, the delivering point, that is government offices and all these facilities that we have established in this system, is still predominantly run by the upper caste people who still try to use it for their own benefits, no matter what the policy is about and no matter what the policy is trying to address. Most of the policies that we have towards inequality, or we have towards poverty, we have towards discrimination and inequalities, all these end up being held or kind of suppressed in the office levels. It never reaches the population that it should actually reach. So that is a fundamental problem with our bureaucracy. So in bureaucracy, as long as we have the 90% from the higher and the middle level social strata representing these bureaucracies, we are not going to see any significant changes, given the policies are still good and the policies are really addressed towards the issues.
So are you trying to say these policies are reflective of a lack of ground level engagement?
Yeah, very much. And as long as you don't have the engagement till the very last person in the society, whatever is the motive of the policy, it is not going to reflect fully, be it in statistical level or be it in a socially visible level. We are not going to see any change. So I would suggest representation is a really important concept that has to be discussed, and especially during times like this where we are experiencing all-time low blows in economy and all-time low indicators in social level statistics. So this is a really good time to bring in conversations about representation. Representation in bureaucracy and in the governance can only bring in a positive, visible change in the society.
Okay. So we have reservation policy in place. So, but still, there's an underwhelming representation of, you know, people from marginalized communities, be it in the top tier institutes like IIT, IIMs, and something as supreme or let's say a profession like, profession would be the word here. Let's say Supreme Court, the panel of judges. So that's the highest degree of decision-making agency I would identify as. So why is that so?
Let me add parliament to that.
Parliament, yes.
So when we talk about representation and people's representatives are going to be there, parliament is also a really nice example for representation that we have right now. See, we have representation policies like reservation in place, in court also, in the parliament also, in education, in government employment. See, private employment, people are demanding reservation and people are denying reservation. There is a big debate going on. Leaving that aside, still government jobs and government positions, bureaucracy, judiciary and the legislative assembly all have a very strict reservation policy, which is defined by the constitution itself. But we still see all these disparities. Why is the question, right? The point is, the reservation policy that we are practicing right now has a lot of shortcomings, I would say. Shortcomings as in, I wouldn't blame the policy, but in the implementation and also in the interpretation and understanding that the people have. So the way reservation is seen by the people matters a lot for it to work effectively. So I am, let's say, I am taking an analogy which will be relevant to this current times. Let's say COVID pandemic was widespread and they made a vaccine. And the vaccine has a very low acceptance or very low public image. Do you think, no matter how powerful and how effective the vaccine is, do you think the people would be willing to take the vaccine and the government will be able to make the vaccine available for every last person, as long as they have the stigma or the misunderstanding that the vaccine is not good or that the vaccine is bad for health? There were misinformations like that, right?
Yes.
And government has to make really strict measures like mandation, certification being necessary for certain things,
yes, yes,
and pushing actual like PR ads in phone calls, through TV and radios, that the vaccine is actually good, go take it. When are we ever going to do that about reservation? So reservation is still being perceived as that bad medicine or the conspiracy of uplifting one section and discriminating me. That is how it is perceived by the existing privileged class of our society. So they think reservation is bad for them. So when we establish the fact that reservation is in place to benefit them as well as the people who have never seen benefits, until and unless we make this awareness a big thing and we do the positive imaging or positive profiling towards the reservation policy, not passively or simply by education, actively advertising it or promoting it, actually explaining it to people and also educating children from the very young age. So until and unless there is a really positive image that forms about reservation, I don't think the policy is going to benefit us in the representation. You can ask me, because of this misunderstanding, is it ineffective? It is effective. It represents people. It brings in representation to the people who have never been represented before this policy. But the point is, people who believe in that misinformation, people who believe in that fake propaganda, people who believe in the existing hierarchy still come into that representation. A Dalit person who believes in caste hierarchy comes into that position. A Dalit person or a tribal person who believes in the caste hierarchy comes into power. Dalit politician who accepts or agrees with the caste hierarchy comes into power. So what is the point? Until and unless we make the necessity and also the idea and philosophy behind reservation a big thing of education and promotion, we are not going to see fruitful outcomes out of that policy any soon. So we have had reservation and representation policies and affirmative actions since independence. And all these 7 decades, we haven't gotten anywhere significantly forward. The reason is this.
Okay. So you're trying to say that it is a social instinct that need to be cultivated. And for this to happen, there must be an ongoing dialogue which must be established around the principles of equality and equity and how it differs from each other. So this need-based support is the need of the hour.
Definitely there should be dialogues and conversations that should be had on the surface level by the activists and by the people who want to support it. And there should also be promoted active participation by the government to educate people towards this, be it on the school level, college level, or be it on a social and societal level. This should be a thing. So until and unless you talk about it and let people know why it is there, what is going on, and what is their pathway for betterment, they're not going to move towards that. They're not going to mobilize towards that. So to push that development idea in their minds, we have to keep having these dialogues and we have to keep the conversations going.
Okay. So to sum up, can we equate the solution to stratification as one that is, let's say, has an emphasis on representation, like any policies that brings in the representation factor?
So basically, the idea is to bring in people from the marginalized, people from the oppressed, and people from the minority to represent themselves in policy making. Then they will make policies that actually address their issues and actually benefits their development or pushes their growth. Once we do that, and we also have enough representation, or so to say equal to the population representation in bureaucracy, we will also have a significantly better and effective working bureaucracy. The same goes for legislative assembly, the same goes for judiciary. Once we put representation in all these places, development and growth for every individual and for every social class and caste and the minority communities is a given. You cannot run away from development at that point. We can go only one way, that is growth. So let's hope that the social change that we are talking about, the equality that we are talking about, see, we are not talking about the dream of socialism here. We are talking about a minimal effort towards socialism where things are at least equal on surface level. So let's hope to bring that surface level change. At least we might work towards that in next decade or two. And let's end this conversation on that hopeful note. Your ending thoughts.
Yeah, ending the conversation to keep the conversation going.
Thank you.